Rod Oram is our business commentator today. A very good morning, Rod.
Good morning, Catherine.
Right. Where are we at in assessing the state of the economy? What is it, 6 weeks on from lockdown, Rod?
I think this past week, since we moved down from level four to level three, has been a good one in terms of the amount of activity that's been coming back, possibly around a million people back working, and all sorts of new areas being opened up, particularly in retail, particularly around sort of takeaway food and contactless consumer activity of various kinds. So I think there's very good adaptability being shown by consumers and customers there. And indeed, for the fast food operations, the likes of McDonald's and KFC have reported very brisk sales that are going a long way towards making up for their loss of in restaurant sales. I think there's a really interesting contrast, though, between us and some other countries. I think here there's less confusion. All right, let me turn that around more positively. There is more clarity about what we're trying to do, articulated by the government and how businesses express this. And therefore, there's less anxiety and fear. And if you look, for example, by comparison, there's a real concern in the UK as they try to reduce restrictions on in the lockdown to in how they're going to encourage people back to work and back to activity. And in the US, it's a great deal worse because there's such great confusion between states and within states about exactly what the state of the epidemic is, and therefore what the risks are, and therefore how you'd proceed. So I think on that basis, we're doing well.
All right, and digging a little deeper?
Well, there are obviously some casualties, and they turn up as in unexpected places. So, for example, yesterday, the law firm Lowndes here in Auckland said it was closing up because of the dearth of corporate mergers and acquisitions work, and it has 23 lawyers and other staff in total. Very interesting reading about what's been going on there. Certainly, Mark Lowndes, well-known in the legal profession, and he is obviously very disappointed that the best option seems to close the firm. He thinks that it's very unlikely that in current conditions any other law firm would be wanting to take on such a reasonable sized group of lawyers and staff. And indeed, it's that loss of mergers and acquisitions business in the corporate sector which is hard hit. So whilst it's been a bit quiet so far in terms of stories like the Lowndes one, we obviously need to prepare for quite a lot more of that news coming through. I think this is a bit of a lull before a storm, if I may say, in terms of how much disruption and dislocation there's going to be out there. Meanwhile, the government has been ramping up new programs, and the particular one that caught my eye last week was the Small Business Cash Flow Loan Scheme. And that's clearly directed, as the name suggests, at small businesses. So this is government loans up to $100,000 for businesses with 50 or fewer employees to help them with cash flow issues, particularly issues like covering their rent. And the loans are interest-free if they're repaid within the first year, and they have 3% interest for a five-year term thereafter. And interesting, though, the delivery is going to be by IRD, which I think is an innovative way of for the government to draw on a government agency, which has very impressive systems. Indeed, IRD took the opportunity during the lockdown to do the next phase of its migration to new systems. And so I thought it was a very interesting idea to have IRD play that role. The next thing we're obviously very focused on is the budget Thursday of next week. And the government is promising a lot further and more help for the economy. So it'll be very interesting to see how that works through. But particularly, my personal hope would be a greater expression from the government about the long-term recovery and then rebuild looks like, rather than just a continuing series of one-off programs to fix issues as they're arising. And last but not least, both of the two main credit rating agencies, Standard & Poor's and Moody's, in recent days have reaffirmed New Zealand's high ratings. And I have to put this in context, the positive outlook for the economy and government finances, but that's compared with the rest of the world. We are in recession. There's no two ways about that. The government's finances have changed dramatically, but they, of course, went into this with very low debt. So in comparison with other countries, our economy is looking, and these are relative terms, less stressed, as are the government's finances, compared with many other countries.
The other big story about, of course, is the turmoil in the global oil sector. I was speaking earlier to our guests as to whether this is a situation forced by circumstances that will see a rebound afterwards, or whether it may lead to a more profound shift. What's your take on what's happening?
The extraordinary events we've seen in recent weeks with, for example, the key benchmark US West Texas intermediate crude trading. I need to explain this carefully. They are futures contracts, but they're for actual delivery of the product. So the month just expiring was trading at a negative price. In other words, the producers were, in essence, paying people to take the oil off their hands. And that's because there's a huge storage problem, i.e. demand is very low, but production is still continuing. And there have been some production cutbacks, not just in the US, but elsewhere. But far more oil is being pumped than used. You can certainly imagine that 6, 9 months, a year ahead, a fair amount of that demand will come back, but some of it won't come back at all fast, not the least of which, for example, aviation fuel. There's just going to be far fewer flights for a very long time. So the structural problems in the global oil industry are really starting to hit home. So you get this extraordinary competition between Saudi Arabia, which remains a very low-cost producer of oil, trying to maximize the revenues it can, while it's because it knows it will never be able to sell all the oil it's got. You know, we'll be have moved on from oil before it's managed to exhaust its reserves, putting enormous pressure on prices elsewhere. And then in the US, where the US has successfully ramped up its production through fracking, but that's been very highly dependent on fracking companies being able to borrow very large sums of money to do that at very low interest rates, and yet still end up relatively expensive producers compared with people like Saudi or countries like Saudi Arabia. So there is all that turmoil going on. And I think that my view is that oil prices are going to remain very depressed. And what we've seen is a massive cutback in exploration and development budgets by all oil companies, typically by a third or a half. And that makes very good sense to me, because we know that the sector globally already has more proven reserves than it will ever be able to burn if we're ever going to deal with climate change. So in other words, it is makes complete nonsense that roughly about two-thirds of the cash flow from the oil and gas industry, about one-third goes out to shareholders in dividends and repaying debt, but the other two-thirds gets plowed back into finding more of the stuff. That obviously makes no sense. So I think that this is a very, very fundamental and crucial turning point for the whole sector. However, trying to offer some view about how this works out over coming years, I just think the dislocation in the sector is going to be enormous. I wouldn't like to predict what's going to go on. But we're already seeing some of those impacts flowing through in New Zealand, in particular with three recent stories.
Let's delve into them.
Well, the first one is ONV, which is an Austrian company, and its production in New Zealand delivers about half our oil and gas. It has been on a drilling campaign for a number of wells since late last year, and it said very little about the first wells in that campaign, and therefore we can only assume that those prospects weren't at all promising. But a few weeks ago, it said that it had a promising well, and this is makes perfect sense geologically. It's only about 50 kilometers offshore Taranaki. So in other words, it's exactly in the geology and geography that the government is allowing exploration to still continue. And indeed is still offering licenses there. In the latest round, one new license exploration license was granted. It said very little about what this what might be the scope of this this reasonable looking find, but if it does bear out to be quite a big one, it would be the first major one in about 10 years. So it allays the fears that we're going to run out on current known reserves. We've got about 10 years supply of gas, so that is good news. However, it stopped doing the rest of the program. It said that was the case because of COVID was making it too difficult to renew crews for the foreign-owned drilling platform and all those sorts of issues. But of course, meanwhile, its parent company in Austria had been slashing expenditure, just as other companies have been doing. So whilst there are obviously those COVID complexities, and those are perfectly legitimate, the fact remains is that spending the money on doing other drilling, even if they were able to, probably doesn't make much sense. So that's good news, because that helps tide us over until we get beyond oil and gas, if that well eventuates. The second story was about New Zealand Refining, which owns the Marsden Point Refinery, owned by our three major oil companies active in New Zealand, but also investors in the stock market. And it's undertaking an urgent strategic review because it feels that its current business model is no longer economically viable. And again, this is a real telltale sign of what's going on in the sector, because the refinery has to operate in a way that delivers product refined petrol and diesel at a price that's competitive with just importing the finished product itself. And that's proving harder and harder to do because of excess capacity, larger scale operations overseas with greater efficiencies, and all those other sorts of issues. So the whole future of the refinery, which of course dates back to Think Big days, many decades, is up in the air. And it's going to be fascinating to see what they decide. The one key asset that does obviously have a life is the pipeline down from Marsden Point to Auckland, and one which is very profitable for NZ Refining. And even if the refinery ceased refining, it would be very logical for Marsden Point to be the delivery point for imported fuels, and then use the pipeline to bring them down to the main market in Auckland, but then also to transship in its coastal tankers from Marsden Point around the rest of the country. And then the third story, again, is equally fascinating because it's, again, another aspect of all this. The Tui oil field was once our largest producer, but it was getting very close to the end of its economic life when it was taken over by ultimately a Singapore-owned company called Tamarind. It had a drilling setback with a dry well in its hope to extend the oil field, and then Tamarind went into receivership in Singapore, and the whole company's been wound up. So the great concern here was that all the existing infrastructure in the Tui oil field, the wellheads on the seabed floor and the floating production ship, which collects that oil through pipelines, was in limbo. So our Environmental Protection Agency has taken control of this to shut down and seal off the wells, decommission those pipes from the wellheads, and ultimately enable the production ship to move away off the oil field. But the cost is huge. The cost of doing this is going to be about $100 million. And therefore, our government is trying to seek that from the receivers of Tamarind to make sure that New Zealand taxpayers don't bear the cost of that. There's one part of the story I'm afraid I haven't quite clarified, the extent to which there are bonds in place that survive the receivership, and therefore the government, our government, might have some access there. But again, if you look at just Tui, that's a tiny example of what's going to be happening around the world. Already in the US, quite a few wells being shut in. Already in the North Sea, people are starting to think about the end of North Sea oil and gas production, where there is the most extraordinary decommissioning job to do on the thousands of miles of seabed pipelines and thousands of wellheads there, wells that need to be properly capped off so that they are secure and won't leak in the years ahead. So what we're doing with Tui is just a tiny example of an enormous global undertaking that's necessary as we gradually phase out of fossil fuels.
It was interesting. I know you've had a chance to hear the head of the New Zealand Super Fund this morning in a conversation we were having about institutional investors pushing, well, this is right around the world, in a combined effort, pushing for investments and infrastructure upgrades and stimulus to be looking over the horizon, in fact, looking not even over the horizon anymore. And quite interesting, you know, they are open for business as well. They are open for projects that are part of a transition that's long been talked about but slow to happen, Rod. And of course, New Zealand has a high level of renewables at the moment, about 85%, I think, isn't it? But if we get this transition into electric vehicles, we're going to be needing more power. We're going to be needing upgrades. As he said, Tiwa Point closes. We're going to need infrastructural work done to link that electricity supply fully up to the grid. So the pieces of the puzzle are kind of coming together. They just need some impetus, don't they?
They do. At one level, I'm excited about that, but with two reservations. The first one is that I still think the thought around this is not taking a big enough leap. In many cases, it's still about sort of greening a little bit what we're already doing. It's not about the huge transformation. So, for example, entirely zero emissions light vehicles, almost certainly going to be electric rather than hydrogen, but that's the leap to take. The second one is that economic conditions are actually going to get harder over the next few years. And I think there will be a lot of fear, a lot of exhaustion, a great desire to fall back to however imperfect the past was. But that just feels easier than pushing on to a better future. So I think to push, demand, encourage, and otherwise try to exert some real leadership in all this is certainly the role of people like organizations like the Superannuation Fund, but it's actually a role for all of us, whether you're starting with what we change in our own lives, in our own behavior, to thus encourage the companies that we deal with as consumers to push on, because that's the only place we we can go. We can't just fall back. It's completely extraordinary that we've been running a global economic system that falls apart if it's running at about 95% of capacity. So even in a normal recession, a little cyclical recession where an economy might shrink by 1 or 2%, you know, that puts great stresses and strains. But now we're of course in a completely different territory. So just that single fact alone should be should give great clarity to people in their thinking about how enormous and huge, but ultimately beneficial, the opportunity is here to essentially remake a lot of what we do.
Thank you, Rod Oram, business commentator.